Episode 3 of the podcast, How Did I Get Here? I'm your host, Johnny Gowdy. I talk to musicians. We have conversations about what it is that they do, how they got where they're at, and their business, their creative process, sometimes life experiences that inform their music, in hopes that if you're a fan of the band, you'll get a chance to listen to them talk about things you don't normally get to hear them talk about in a conversational setting. And if you don't know the band, it'll give you a chance to get to know them, give you a better connection when you go and listen to them for the first time. So hopefully you're getting something out of this. I know I am. This is my third one. I've been having a great time doing this. I've actually gotten really into the albums of the people that I've interviewed. I love Susanna's album so much. I love the Sounds Under Radio album so much that that podcast was posted today. I got a little feedback from that. My friend Aaron Quadra. From Houston, said that he really liked it. I wish I had a different kind of feedback. Maybe people would start writing. Uh-oh, they're coming for me. I gotta go. Anyway, sorry. Also, my aunt gave me some feedback. She liked it, and she bought the Sounds Under Radio album. So there you go. Hopefully this is coming across and getting to people, and they're getting into it. Episode 3, which is today. Today's episode is an interview with Nathan Singleton. He is in the band The Sideshow Tragedy. They just put out an EP, made a video. They're doing a tour. I think they're on that tour right now, so you can look them up at thesideshowtragedy.com and get to know them, see if they're coming to your town, see if you like them in this podcast. I hope you do. I certainly did. I enjoyed my conversation with Nathan a lot. And we're going to have some good shows coming up. I've interviewed Donnie Wynn, who's a drummer from, Robert Palmer. He played through all the records that you know of Robert Palmer, from Doctor, Give Me the News to Heavy Nova, which was a Simply Irresistible record. He's a very entertaining cat. He's got a cool story. He knew a lot of cool guys, and so he also talks a lot about Robert Palmer. You get to learn a lot about him and what he was like. So, and we got some upcoming shows. Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's, namely, has said yes, that she was into doing it. Miles Zuniga from Fastball is into doing it. Casey McPherson from Alpha Rev is into doing it. Joseph King from Deadbeat Darling is into doing it. So it's just a matter of getting all these people over to my apartment to have this conversation. The Go-Go's are on tour until the end of the month. It's Tuesday, August 16th. I did this interview that you're about to listen to with Nathan Singleton from The Sideshow Tragedy last Thursday. He came over. I did learn a lot about what he does. I learned a lot more about him than I knew, and I found him to be a really intelligent and somewhat enigmatic fellow. He won't say the name of the town he's from or any of his bands before the Sideshow Tragedy. So hopefully you'll find this conversation interesting. I did. I enjoyed my conversation with Nathan, and I hope you do. This is Nathan Singleton from the Sideshow Tragedy. Gasoline from a Sideshow Tragedy. The Sideshow Tragedy, right?
Yeah.
This is Nathan Singleton from the band. It's a two-man band. One guy plays drums. His name is Jeremy. What's his last name?
Harold.
Jeremy Harold plays the drums. And Nathan Singleton plays guitar and sings. This coffee's delicious.
This beer's good.
All right. So this is finally a rock and roll. Are you getting both headphones and everything?
I'm getting them, yeah. It's a little short now, but whatever.
So you guys just put out an EP a couple months ago. It's called Gasoline. Tell me about that.
Well, the EP, without like boring you with the details of our, you know, we've been around for like almost 6 years, I guess.
No, we'll get through all that.
But it's
I have an arc.
Oh, okay.
An arc to a story.
All right, you got it planned
out. This is the thing. I've been watching Dateline in 48 Hours a bunch. What you do is you come in and you kind of give the person a little shake up, like, oh, this is this person's life, and they're like, what? And then you go back to the beginning.
Okay.
Right? After the commercial break.
Some kind of Orson Welles thing.
Totally Orson Welles.
Yeah, I like that.
That's why I'm growing a beard.
It looks good. So we started as a two-piece band. I wanted to play some songs. And I didn't want to have like a full band. I was actually going to do a solo, but you know, I thought it, being on the road by myself would be boring. So I asked my friend Jeremy to play drums. And so we started as a two-piece, and it was kind of a little folkier, a little bit more like singer-songwriter stuff. And it kind of got more like more rock and roll, and we added a bass player and, you know, made records that way for a few years. And then our bass player quit, and we replaced him just kind of momentarily with your bandmate, Jeremy Nail.
Yeah.
Played
the great
bass.
Jeremy Nail.
Yes. So when Justin quit, Jeremy played bass for us for a little bit, and then we kind of thought, well, maybe we'll just go back to our roots. I was starting to think about going in a more like kind of hard blues direction, I guess, like, you know, like harder, more garage rock type of thing.
Something that, I don't know if it started there, but something that a version of the blues that first time I ever saw it like that was the John Spencer Blues Explosion.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, not, and that's like not having a bass player, because they didn't have a bass player. I mean, they're kind of based on like Hound Dog Taylor. He didn't have a bass player. R.L. Burnside played without a bass player, just had Kenny Brown playing guitar and his grandson playing drums. And I mean, really, when you go back and look at like older blues types, like the really like early electric stuff, it's like, you know, it would be like a guitar player, a singer, and a stand-up bass player and harmonica player, or a guy playing, you know, it was never like it was never the standard like drums, bass, guitar, rock and roll arrangement until later. It got more kind of standardized, I guess, and then like the power trio became like the way to do like, I guess, blues rock or whatever.
Right, like Cream, is that
right,
what you're referencing?
Yeah, yeah. And trios have always been the way I've done bands ever since I was a kid. I was like, you know, keep it as simple as I could.
And did you always play guitar?
Yeah. And we, you know, it's just about like being as raw as it can be. But anyway, so the EP was just like, okay, as soon as we made the decision to make the record or to make the band this way now, we sounded a lot different. A lot of the songs were radically reworked, and we had a lot of new ones. So it was like, we need to record something as fast as we can, to have a representation of what we sound like now, because we don't sound like our old records at all anymore. Except for, you know, here and there on them. So we recorded Gasoline. My friend Sammy P is a drummer for T-Bird and the Breaks, as an engineer at Big Orange, and I called him up and I was like, you want to, you know, just do an EP like really quick, like in a day? And so we just went into Big Orange and recorded it to tape. Like, took about,
so you did this EP to tape?
Yeah, it was recorded 2-inch tape, and most of the songs are, we did the guitars and the drums live. Most of it's first take, one take, and then I overdubbed a few guitars, like just for like, you know, to bring the chorus up or whatever. And then I did the vocals, and it took about 8 hours, and
to record the whole EP.
Yeah, and it was just like something, and then we put it out on vinyl, like, you know, limited edition, just so people have, and it's digital download too, but it's just so people can, you know, just so there's something that represents what we sound like now. We're going to make a full length, you know, I'm working on songs for it right now. So, but it was just to get something out as quickly as we possibly could. So that's what we did. We recorded it in November and released it. I guess we had them in hand, and we're selling them and stuff by South By. So it was like, I guess, 3 months from recording to mixing, mastering, and getting the records printed.
So, it sounds great.
Thank you.
It's got so much energy, and the songs are really good. Your voice is great. Your playing is amazing as well. When we did a show together in Dallas, It's always good when you say you live in the, we live in the same town. A lot of people that are going to come on here, we all live in the same town. We kind of see each other at the same clubs, mm-hmm. in front of the same people. You know what I mean? And then you get out and you get to see someone play in a different setting to a different group of people, and even in front of maybe some of your people that have never seen anything like that. And you really see the magnetism of the way you guys do what you do. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? I mean, it's really attractive and exciting, and the energy is physically there without, mm-hmm. and it's not fake. You know what I mean? Like it's energetic music. So you're just going with the music. And so anyway, I thought that, you know, when I was seeing it, I'm in a band with 7 people. I'm in a band with 5 people. You know, a few years ago, I was like, I'm never going to have less than 5 people in a band because I have this. You realize that really there's so much energy that you can get across with just 2 people, even one of them sitting down. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I mean, it comes from, you know, I think especially with, like, you know, I mean, the fact that the White Stripes and Black Keys have been so, like, hugely successful and popular, right. over the last decade. You see, you know, I think a lot of kids coming up maybe are like, oh, well, we don't need a bass player, so we'll just start a band. And what ends up happening is that they play the songs just like they would if there were a bass player, without kind of compensating for it. And I came up playing, like, almost all of my, like young cutting teeth experiences were playing solo, like, blues. Could play the National Resonator guitars, like, you know, like, listening to pre-war blues, like Book of White and Sun House and these guys who were, you know, they're playing Muddy Waters, they're playing the bass line and the melody, right. You know, so, like, they're playing solo. So I came up playing that way, like, in blues clubs and stuff in East Texas where I'm from. So I you know, it's kind of like I'm trying to do that too. Like, you know, I tune my guitars really low and you know, there's various tech things that I do to make it sound lower or whatever, but the drummer has
mysterious tech things. Do you not divulge your secrets on podcasts?
Well, it's just not like a, I mean, I don't know. I think that stuff's really boring. And if it were, if it were a guitar magazine, I might say something, but that's not, I don't know. I'm not entertained by it usually unless I'm looking for something. But, so we looking for secrets, but you know, try to, you got to compensate. You got to think about the bass line. There's definitely, it's limiting, and I mean, there's a lot you can do with it, but it's limiting. You got to think about the fact there's not a bass player there, so you got to hold that down, you know. And it's a ongoing challenge, which, you know,
is that
fun.
Is a challenge. I mean, you're up there. You're not just playing guitar. You're also focusing. You're playing kind of 2 instruments at the same time, right. And you're playing guitar at the same time. You're singing.
I hybrid pick. There we go.
Yeah.
So there's some guitar nerd stuff. I use a flat pick when pick with my middle finger and ring finger. So,
well, there you go. Hopefully there's a guitar player listening right now.
Secrets divulged.
What was I just saying? Oh my God, I lost my train of thought.
Oh, sorry.
I lose it.
You were talking about it is a challenge.
It is a challenge. You're not just playing two different things on guitar, but then also you're singing and you're entertaining. That's a lot to do. So you must let's go back to East Texas, and we'll get into how you learned how to play guitar and everything. So,
okay,
you were born in East Texas.
Yeah,
where in East Texas?
It's just this little town. You know, it's,
you never heard of it. It's in Canada.
Yeah, it's really boring. You know, but I grew up in just various. Can you curse on here?
Yeah.
Oh, it's like shitty.
Total freedom.
I would call it the general.
Well, no. But where did you were born in East Texas?
Around Tyler, like I lived in, like Tyler, Texas. I lived around there. That's where I started playing in clubs. There's like blues clubs there and stuff. And I actually met there's a guy in a band. You know, the Greyhounds in town.
I think
they're
so.
Kind of like a funk band.
Yeah.
But Andrew Troop, he's from Tyler too. So I remember he's like 4 years older than me. So when I was like a little kid, like trying to learn how to play and stuff, he was already in this band and they were playing in town. So I thought they were like rock stars, you know?
Wow.
But, and then we ended up, you know, we've shared bills in town. And I mean, we started playing together back then, actually, once I got a little older, but just like hanging out with like really old dudes, you know, like old dudes with like, you know, like bass fishing hats on that, you know, play Stratocasters through, you know, Fender amps and,
right.
and like do like a kind of Stevie Ray Vaughan thing. And there I came in, you know, with my my national guitar.
Well, how did you learn? Where did you hear music? How did you know about national guitar? Like, your parents?
My dad was always into all that old blues stuff.
Was he a musician too? Or is he a musician?
He's a musician. He's more of a, I guess like a, I don't know, like dilettante, you know, musician. But he collects, amongst other bizarre esoteric things, he collects pre-war national resonator guitars. So that's how I came across him. Ever since I was a little kid, he was sitting around playing those things, like playing the, I just remember hearing like the Reichhuter music for the movie Paris, Texas, like the soundtrack for Paris, Texas. Like my dad was playing it on records all the time. He's playing it on his guitars. And so it was kind of, I guess, like ingrained in me when I was a kid.
How old were you when you, like, what's your earliest memory? Like
of guitars? Would be that music.
And how old were you?
I was like 4 or 5. I guess that movie came
and
out.
And did you start playing that early?
No, I started playing when I was like 11. That's when I started playing guitar.
What was the impetus? Like, what pushed you over the edge to go, like, you know, go from having them in your house and listening to this music and liking it, loving it, to go all of a sudden going like, you know what, I need to actually grab one of these and.
Well, it's, I don't, you know, it's weird. Like, I think it seems like most of the people that I know, like my friends and stuff that play music, kind of got into it a little bit later than I did, like maybe more around 14 or 15.
Right.
But I don't know if it's because my dad played guitar or what, but I just remember anytime I saw, another early memory I have is like seeing Jimi Hendrix on a television program when I was like 6 and just being like, you know, what the hell is that? That's like, that dude's amazing. Like, you know,
you got it. What did you like about it? Like, was it freedom? Did it represent freedom to you? Because you lived in a little town that was shitty, or did it?
Well,
did
it, later on, have, later did it have on, this it did
wild
for sure.
Shit you never heard, and you just. Liked
I don't think
music.
I even understood it. You know, it was just. I mean, like the Stones too. Like, I guess when I started playing, actually, originally I wanted to be a drummer, and my dad talked me out of it. I think because drums are more expensive.
So, and like, plus, they're also the parents' nightmare.
Right, they're super loud. So he talked me out of it, and. He told me that you want to play guitar because you'll get more girls, but I don't know if that's true. I think all you have to do is play music and you'll just get girls. I don't think it really matters. But I started playing guitar and I was really into the Stones, Rolling Stones, which is also kind of bizarre, I guess, for an 11-year-old kid to be.
And what year was that? What year were you 11? Like, what was popular at the time?
We're talking 92, I guess. So
like Boys to Men and Boys Nirvana.
Boys to Men, Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. I mean, even the dudes that I knew were into that. And and Nirvana, which I think Nirvana is great, but at the time I wasn't into it. I got it later, you know. I wasn't really into anything that was kind of happening
current.
At the time. Yeah,
you
I was
were into more, and even like what Stones were you into? Were you listening to like psychedelic Stones, or were you listening to like blues based Stones, where they're still doing like Muddy Waters songs
well,
and shit like that?
All of it. Originally, it was just like anything Rolling Stones. I mean, I was like, you could have. I mean, I would have made the argument that Emotional Rescue is one of the best records of all time at that time. But
I still do.
Well, I mean, but probably like Beggar's Banquet, Exile on Main Street, you know, Sticky Fingers, like that classic.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the Jimmy Miller records.
They were doing their, they became themselves, where they became the Stones. They had the riff that opened the song with the tuning and everything, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I was really into that stuff, and I kind of had like a thing, like anything that's made nowadays can't be good, you know.
Did you get that from your dad? Was your dad one of those cats? Like, since he was collecting pre-war resonators, did he walk around the house, there's MTV, you don't have to do anything to do that, you just have to be pretty?
Actually, no, because he was really into he was into Soundgarden and Collective Soul. He loved those bands.
Really?
Yeah, he would sit around and watch MTV until those videos came out and be like, this is great, this is good stuff. That Soundgarden,
is he a young dad? Like,
No, he's old. He's, I mean, older than me. Like, he was probably... He's probably like 29 or something when I was born.
It's like
something like that.
You're from this unnamed town in Texas. You don't want to talk about it because it's a place where your dad might not be older than you.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Totally. My dad's
That's not even inbreeding. It's like something else. It's like a mystical force.
He's also my grandpa. but yeah, and my stepdad turned me on to Cream, I guess. So I was into
So were your parents divorced when you were young, at a young age?
Yeah, my parents got divorced when I was like 7 or 8.
And they both still lived in the same town?
Mm-mm. My dad actually moved to, this is interesting, I guess, but he moved to, he was a doctor, so he was really into Native American culture and stuff, so he moved to Montana and lived in various places in Montana and South Dakota. So I spent summers with him on Indian reservations, and he's really into Native culture, and he gave me peyote when I was like 11 years old. you know, which I don't know where I'm from in East Texas.
I mean, at least you were with a doctor. That's all I can think is that he was with a doctor.
Yeah, but it was more like, you know, I mean, it's all like, I think, cultural perception. But it wasn't like we were sitting around and my dad's like,
your dad's like secretly
hippie,
Jim Morrison to me.
Yeah, he's like, eat this, man. We're going to go out in the desert. It was like we went to a, you know, like a
sweat lodge.
Like a peyote meeting. Yeah. It's in a teepee. And
right. There's a whole.
It was legitimate. Yeah. Like, it was like a spiritual thing. Yeah. So
it's not like you guys were shooting heroin at the on Bleecker Street.
Right, right. Or he's, you know, he's not like taking me out to, you know, strip clubs and stuff like that. But it was
that's funny. My dad, sorry, that's a quick aside. My dad, when I was, you were 11.
Mm-hmm.
When I was, I think I was 9 or 10. I can verify this with my Uncle Jack. There was a Playboy Club in Miami, and it was the late 70s, and we would go there.
Oh, man. See,
I mean, it wasn't a strip club. It was literally like a legitimate restaurant / club where the chicks just wore the bunny suits and stuff. But, I mean, believe me, when you're like 9 and 10, you know.
That might as well be.
Well, plus my dad would always, and no matter when we went, as soon as, like, I guess I can't think we went more than 3 or 4 times, but in those few years. But, sorry. I would hear them singing Happy Birthday. And it was nowhere near my birthday, right? It'd be like July. My birthday's in October, and I'm sitting there. Yeah, it's Happy Birthday. And I was hip to it after this, but the first time I remember, I was like, wow, I wonder whose birthday it is. These ladies come up, and he would always tell them it was my birthday. It's amazing.
Yeah, anyway, that's actually even cooler than this, I think.
Well, but, no, I mean, if our dads could have gotten together, we could have been like, you know,
yeah,
tripping on acid at the Playboy.
Right, totally.
At the Playboy Club in Miami. Anyway, so go ahead. So your dad turned you on to some peyote and such. So did you, you were 11. Did you get the spiritual ramifications of a sweat lodge? I mean, did you understand what these people were going for? Did you understand what you were going through?
I think so. Yeah, well, I mean, I was into, I mean, actually, like, I went to a sweat lodge, like, minus hallucinogenics when I was, like, 9, I guess, like, the first time I did that. But, I mean, he was always, like, you know, and then, you know, from East Texas, which is fairly, like, you know, kind of fundamentalist religious type place. So it was always cooler to me because I was also into, like, you know, like, counterculture literature and, like, the Beats and you know, Hunter S. Thompson and...
Well, how old were you when you got into that?
Probably around the same time, like 11 or 12.
Wow, yeah, that's started, amazing.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, they were all on my dad's bookshelf and stuff, so just...
Do you not have a TV or something? You didn't have a Nintendo? I'm really concerned about this upbringing you had.
I had a Nintendo. You know, it was just like, I was just kind of drawn to the whole thing, like just the you know, bohemianism through the ages of thing from the Lost Generation in Paris to Henry Miller to Jack Kerouac
and all that stuff has informed your life. I mean, you know, 60s. You're like a troubadour, a songwriter. You know, you travel in a van.
It's kind of, you know, it's a cliche or whatever, I think, but I think it's important to me. I mean, even, you know, especially as like cynical and stuff as rock and roll or whatever has become, and it's, you know, it's just kind of another way to sell a car now. But it's still good. It's still good to have. It's still. I mean, that's what was attractive to me about it was the. I didn't want to be like a guy who wore a suit and had a job and stuff. Like, I wanted to.
The shackles. You wanted the freedom.
Right. Which is a total cliche, but I guess, you know, like, I feel.
No, it's not, but it's interesting because, in some way, probably subconsciously, you drew a line between what you saw Jimi Hendrix doing and what you were reading, you know.
Yeah.
The you know, Jack Kerouac, you know.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of life. Just
it is. It's powerful, you know. Like, yeah. I mean, it was.
It's attractive. I mean, we do the same thing.
Exactly. You know, like, it's like you don't, you know, well, especially I just remember just how, like, totally, I mean, I don't know. I don't really want to, like, talk bad about anybody, but I mean, just how oppressive, school and
oh yeah, yeah.
And just the society that I grew up in. Yeah. It's like, I know, I'm saying, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I said, I'm gonna be a guitar player. And they're like, well, what are you going to do for a job?
Right,
and I was like, I'm going to be a guitar player. And they would just try to, I mean, they did everything they could to beat that out of me. Like, no, you can't do that. It's irresponsible. You're not going to make any money. Right. And it's like, well, I'm 30 years old and I'm still more, you know, like, no, this is what I do. Like, I mean, you can do it. You move away, you go to the city, you meet people that do it too. And it's like, oh, ha ha ha. Of course, you know, now that's over. Right. But I still, it's very fresh on my mind and my emotions, how oppressive that environment is, you know?
Yeah, it totally is.
When I have a child, I'm going to, you know, be sure to be like, look, man, it's all okay. It's going to be over soon. Don't worry. But he'll probably grow up and be an accountant, you know, seeing the way I live.
That's true. That's true. Well, you never know. He might pull your resonator off the wall. And
that's true, too. I mean, it seems like, you know, they always say, like, well, children rebel against their parents. But I know so many people whose parents were musicians, and they're musicians, too.
Right.
I think it's just all around, like, a cooler, more fun way to
live. People actually rebel against that, the whole, like, you know, suit. You got to do this and live a certain way.
Yeah. But, you know, they might rebel against the music. Like, you know, Jerry Garcia's daughter was friends with Tupac Shakur and hung out with gangster rappers and stuff, rather than, you know, Bob Weir and Fish or whatever.
Right. It's freaky. So you were living in West Texas. Did you have or East Texas, sorry. And you had when did you start your first band?
Started my first band when I was pretty much immediately after I started playing guitar. It was me and these other guys who didn't know how to play guitar either, and we started a band. Like, first real band, I guess. Like, I mean, I was always in a band through high school, but it wasn't like ever like a, it wasn't ever like a real band that played shows and stuff. So I guess like when I first started doing it and actually like playing out in clubs, like I started playing out in clubs when I was 15. Had my first paying gig on my 18th birthday. And played music up until
How much did you get paid?
$75.
That's good.
For a 45-minute set. And then I went and got a tattoo, and then I went to watch the Black Crowes in Dallas that night. So it was a good day. But the
you're pointing at something behind me. I was like,
oh no.
There's a spider on your shoulder.
Get it off.
When did you see the Ian Moore show where you first saw a guy play guitar? How old were you then?
I was like 11, 12. Like, it was right when I started playing guitar. Right.
And did that make you play guitar?
No, I think I'd been playing guitar for maybe, let's see, that was in, I think it was in the fall, like October, November. It was at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas. And I think I'd started playing guitar like that summer.
Okay.
So I'd been playing guitar for about 4 months.
And then
months.
That kind of like, you were like, fuck yeah, that is the shit.
Oh yeah, dude. I mean, as soon as and then you see all the freaks that are at concerts, you know, like I grew up in a small town and then you go to this big concert and there's chicks with their tits out. There's like dudes out of their fucking mind on acid, bunch of hippies, bunch of like,
especially at a Stones show. Cause
you get everybody. Yeah. And I'm just this little kid and I was there with my stepdad, like just totally like freaked out little kid. But like, you know, walking around like, oh my God, this is everything that like your church and your school teachers and everybody warns you about and says, don't do this. And I was like, this is what I'm doing.
Right.
This is exactly where I'm going to be.
I always felt like that too. I didn't have a lot of, societal, don'ts. Mm-hmm. But, so that's interesting. So on your 18th birthday, you got your first paying gig. And then what did you do? You were gonna bolt out of a little town in East Texas, right?
Yeah, no, I went to UT. It was really important to me to just immediately leave. Like to get out. I mean,
now do you have friends there or anything? I mean, does it chase you? I mean, like, are you running from that place? A lot of people do that. Like,
I'm not running from it. I mean, one of my best friends.
That was really dramatic.
Yeah, no, I was.
Are you running from that little town in East Texas?
I went back there. I went back there not too long ago, hung out with some old friends and stuff. I actually wish I could hang out with some of those guys more often. Like, I have good friends there, you know?
Right.
It's not, I mean, the thing is, it's not like it's not a terrible place. It's just like, what am I going to do? You know,
right.
What's a guitar player going to do there? So, and I just kind of like being able to, you know, have a pick of more than two restaurants. It's just a personal preference. I think if you want to live in a more cosmopolitan area or not. Some people prefer peace and quiet.
Right.
But peace and quiet drives me nuts.
There's a ceiling. You know what I mean? There's a ceiling. You'll only know so many people. You'll only have so many experiences, and you wanted to live, you know, without any kind of Some people don't see them as shackles. So I guess certain people that are considered free-spirited will find something like that shackled, consider something like that shackles, you know, that are holding them back, mm-hmm. when other people would find it really comforting, you know.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I've got my life, and, you know, I don't really have to deal with weird people. I don't have to deal with those bikers at the Stones concert.
Well, yeah, and I think there's something to be said for...
Did anyone ever discourage you from the big city? Like, you're gonna die there,
absolutely.
You're gonna die.
No, that was like my family, like, you know, like my I mean, and they're not... Of course, they're wonderful people. Like, I love them, but, you know, it was very much like, you know, when I started playing guitar, I was like, all right, we have to go to a concert now. You know, I was trying to get my dad to take me to a concert, and... You know, God bless my stepdad. He took me to concerts, you know, like he would...
What else did you see? You saw the Stones and
Ian Moore
and Bryan Adams.
My second concert was I think, Horde Festival, which had, like, Black Crowes and Wilco and Blues Traveler, Ziggy Marley, Jayhawks. It was some good bands. It was cool. But, you know, they would be like, oh, man, you can't go there. You have to go to the big city. There's a bunch of traffic.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to get mugged. We're going to get raped by transsexuals. You know, all of these things that are, I mean, I guess, I mean, of course, there's a kernel of truth there, but it's more exciting.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great essay by poet Charles Simic about, I think it's called something like smoked sausage or something. And it's about the smells of the city and about how when he was a kid, he grew up, he's from Yugoslavia and he moved to the United States, during World War II, I guess, or sometime around when they were having like civil wars in the Slavic countries. And he grew up in New York City and Chicago, and he talked about when he was a kid and his, you know, the teachers and the parents would take him out to the country to get some fresh air. And he was always like, no way, man.
I want to smell smoked sausage.
Yeah, I want to smell smoked sausage. I want to smell pollution. I want the hustlers, the beggars, the prostitutes, all of that. Like the colorful, you know,
and the
anonymity too, you know, you can do whatever you want.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, it's where I'm from. I guess is, you know, it's always a part of me, like, that, you know, being a country boy in the city. But I don't know. I always felt like a fish out of water, even when I was a very little kid. You know, like, this is not,
that's interesting,
not where I belong. I always felt that way.
I wonder if most people that move away like that have always, you know what I mean, or if they just wake up one day, or if they open, you know, they get cable and they're like,
I don't know. I was like, man, I want to go to. I remember being a little kid, being like watching Ghostbusters. And I was like, wow, look at this place. Like, because it's filmed in New York City.
Right.
And I was like, oh, man, you know, this is where I want to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody would be like, oh, you know, good God Almighty, I ain't never going to New York City. I've never
You're
been.
You're going to die there.
Yeah, if you see a sign that says New York City 100 miles away, you need to turn around and go the other way.
Yeah.
You know, that's very much the thinking of where I'm from. And I was like, man, no way, dude.
Yeah, I'm going for it.
There's Ninja Turtles and Ghostbusters in New York City. They don't have that around where I'm from.
Right. So you moved to Austin, you went to UT. What were you majoring in? Were you music or like?
Cultural anthropology.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which, you know, has something to do, I'm sure.
Did you graduate?
Yep.
With a degree in cultural anthropology?
Yep. I have a bachelor's degree.
Okay.
As Jeremy Nail would say, I can pump gas all I want, anywhere I want.
Yeah.
You know,
with man.
Yeah, with my anthropology degree. But yeah, it's
so is that when you did you start playing when you moved to Austin? Did you start a band? Did you look in the newspapers? How did you what did you do? Did you know Jeremy?
No, I didn't meet him till much later. I had friends here. I kind of came here and ended up playing with like punk rock bands and stuff. Like I was in the, you know, I was one of those like kids who hung out at Emo's every night, you know. With eyeliner on and stuff. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. That was how I That wasn't how I started out in music, but when I moved to Austin, it was like, I don't want to play blues. This stuff's boring. I don't want to do anything like this. Like, I want to hang out with old dudes. I'm tired of this crap. I'm moving to Austin. I'm going to be like, you know, hang out with cool
what
kids.
What attracted you to punk rock? Do you think there's some kind of, there's a line between blues and punk rock.
The thing that's attractive about punk rock to me is the, more so than any kind of aesthetic or like the musical aspect of it. What's attractive to me is the kind of like confrontational, you know, like nonconformity, I guess.
Right.
Like the shocking aspect of
it. Right.
Which goes back to like New York Dolls. Like
yeah.
For me, like these guys dressed up like women.
Yeah.
They're really freaky looking and they shock the hell out of like anybody who didn't live, you know, on the Bowery. Right. And anywhere else in America, people are like, oh my God, you know? And
I would love it if the New York Dolls would have come to your town.
Right. Well, see, I used to, when I was in high school, I'd wear my girlfriend's halter tops to school and paint my fingernails and stuff. And, you know, it's totally, it just,
awesome.
Yeah, it's one of those things I think where either you get why that's funny or fun or distracting or not. You know, it's like, why would you want to do that? You know, you're asking to be beat up.
Right.
But I don't know. It was just one of those things.
Like, so did you play a lot? Did you have a band that was doing stuff? Or
in high school, no.
No. I mean, when you moved to Austin.
Yeah.
You were hanging out at Emo's and you were also playing there?
Yeah, I was in a band with some guys. And I mean, I was like a lead guitar player. I kind of went through like a little crisis where I didn't know if I was really a good singer or not. Like, because I didn't sing. I mean, my voice is kind of really coming from like a classic rock, like, you know, someone like, I don't know, Eric Burden or
right
or you know something yeah, like that. That's how I sing. Yeah. So, which is not cool at all in right. indie rock and punk rock. So, you know, people are like, I don't like the way that guy sings. You know, right. I would get all these things, and people would become like, hey, dude, your band's good, man, but you can't sing. Like, and you know, I'm singing like these old blues guys,
and, right? And they just kind of saw you as sounding like that Taylor Hicks guy from American Idol
like,
or something,
like just like dinosaur rock dudes. Like, what is this? You know, or who does he think he is?
Right.
And so,
there's a lot of attitude in that scene.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think
right?
there's
punk rock.
Yeah, I mean, there's attitude in any scene. I wasn't playing like real punk rock or anything like you know. Like,
no, but you were like, what years is it, like late 90s or something?
No, well, early 2000s, okay. But it was like you know, I'm playing it was punk rock, but not like you know, punk is kind of like this big huge word.
Right.
You know, it was more like indie rock, like emo punk / metal, I guess.
Okay.
Or, you know, if you want to break it down, I was playing right. like lead guitar. I mean, the arrangements were in our songs and in certain bands were pretty, pretty complicated, I guess, you know? Okay. So it was definitely
a little prog in there.
Yeah. And you know, it wasn't really my thing, but I really wanted to like, you know, I wanted to not do blues. I wanted to get away as far away from that as I could. I wanted people my own age to think that I was cool.
Right, okay, cool.
So that's what I was doing, I guess. Even though it was kind of running away from like, you know, what I grew up on and stuff. It was like all these old dudes and stuff would be like, "Man, you're great, man. I like what you do,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah.
You're really good, man." And then
but your own peers didn't want
to. Yeah, my little kid friends would be like,
right.
"You suck, dude. You suck. Yeah. Why don't you play good music?"
So where how long did you go in that scene doing that kind of music? Like where what was the?
It was just like a few years, just a couple years. I okay. Fronted my own band and then it went away and I played guitar in this other band. Actually, kind of what started it was a friend of mine. He wanted to. He was in a lot of those bands. He was like, you name a band in the late 90s, early 2000s that was in the emo's kind of scene in Austin, like the, you know, he was. His name's Eric Sanger. He's a good friend of mine, but he was in Pop Unknown. He was in Sparta from El Paso.
Right.
He was a founding member of Sparta. He was in Shotzi.
Yeah.
He was in Kissing Chaos. He was in all of these bands. He was in like 50 bands, but anyways, he's a real cool guy and he wanted to start cause he knew I liked country music and blues. And so he wants to start like, and he's, you know, wearing eyeliner and fingernail polish too or whatever. But he's like, let's start a country band. And I'm like, he goes, I want you to sing. And I'm thinking, I mean, he's a bass player, but he wanted to play drums. And so he's starting this band because
right.
like, he's not really a good enough drummer to where somebody's going to hire him to play drums.
Right, right, right.
But he just wants to do this for fun. And we did like Misfit songs.
I like
songs.
How everyone, always, it's always like someone that decides they want to play drums in the middle of the thing. It's always a country band they start with. You know what I mean? So that's so insulting to like country guys.
Well, really country drums are, I think they're probably harder to play. I'm not a drummer, but I've heard that they're harder to play. It's harder to play country drums than it is to play other stuff because you have to be so solid.
Right.
Like, I yeah, mean, yeah. The, you have to hold that down. Especially, I mean, people are dancing to this music, you know? You always right. got to be like a metronome.
That's true. That's so, true. So he's playing drums and...
Yeah, and I sang and played guitar, and Gabe Gonzalez, who is also... He's Eric's friend. He's in Sparta. He produced first two records, and he plays with Jim Ward. Jim Ward from Sparta's got his own thing, and Gabe plays in that band. He's a good friend of mine. But... He played like, he would put on like a bolo tie and kind of, or dress kind of like a mariachi or something and play lap steel. and like chicken picking guitar and baritone guitar, and I played acoustic guitar and sang. And we did like Murder City Devils songs and Misfits songs in with like some Johnny Cash and also David Allan Coe. But we would, you know, we did it like, we did the country songs more punk rock, and we did the punk rock songs like country. So it was right. like, you know, and I was getting compliments then on my singing and, right. and my stage presence. So I'm starting to think, oh, wow, maybe I'm not so bad at this. And, you know, and then I saw the Towns Van Zandt documentary, Be right. Here to Love Me. And I was like, it was just like right there in the theater. I was like, I'm done. I'm going back. I'm going to be a songwriter and, you know, play, you know, folkish, like blues, you know, kind of music. Like, I'm going to do that again. And it was like, I quit the band that night in the theater in my head. And I was like, I'm done. And we went on a tour and we broke up in San Francisco, I guess, or Las Vegas. We broke up in Las Vegas and we still had shows on the way back. But as soon as I was back, it was like immediately started the Sideshow Tragedy thing.
So how long ago was that? It's 2006.
Yeah.
How did that start? How did you get, you started playing with Jeremy then?
Well, he was actually in that band too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was the drummer in that band. And I told him, I was like, he was like, man, his band broke up. What the fuck am I going to do? You know, it's like, and you know, he's like, you know, he graduated from college and he joins a band, you know, so right. his dad's fucking pissed.
Right.
He's like, what are you doing? And we're driving to California and he's like, man, my dad is going to be mad, dude. I'm fucking wasting all this time and shit. So, you know.
I love how there's that finite thing. Like, if you don't, you know what I mean? I guess, you know, when you're a parent, you worry about your kids, but there's that, well, you got one year to make it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, which is totally like, I mean, you know, like, it's all copacetic.
I'll give you 1 year to make it. Then we'll go by dad's plan. Plan A. so go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm like, yeah, as soon as I get back, I'm going to start playing gigs like by myself. Like, that's what I'm going to do. And, he was like, I'm going with you. Like, whatever you start, like, I'm going with you. And so he was, like, down from day one. Like, I'm your drummer. Like, let's do this shit. So, you know, obviously it was like, cool, let's go. And he was like, and he got the van and everything. Like wow. Dude's, like, dude's been on board.
Another guy gets the van.
Yeah, he's, and well, yeah, and then that van exploded. So I got the van now, but it was my turn.
Right.
But, you know, it was like, he's down from day one, ready to rock. Like, let's do this. Like, let's go on tour. I don't give a shit. This is awesome. Let's play music. Let's only do that. So when you got a guy like that on your side, like it's really nice.
Yeah, it makes all the difference.
And we've been to hell and back, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're closer than brothers.
No. I don't know what that means.
So, you know, as close as you can be.
I totally understand.
Then closer.
So then when did you make an album? You guys toured, you made an album. What's going on here? That was Nathan Singleton's Sideshow Tragedy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Before it was actually the Sideshow Tragedy, it started off as that.
Yeah, it started off with just my name. I thought, you know, I was going to be a songwriter, so I needed to go by my name. But then it was clunky, and I don't really like playing, like, you know, it's unless you have, like, a cool-ass name, you know, like, I don't know, something really badass. Jeremy Nail's a good name, for example.
That's a good name.
You know, Nail. Like, that's, I didn't believe it was his real name when I met him. You know, unless you have a name that sounds like a fake name, that's not going to work. So I dropped the name. Sideshow Tragedy sounds a lot better than Nathan Singleton and his Sideshow Tragedy and various assorted guests, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So, but yeah, we basically just, I mean, immediately started making a record and went on to work.
What was the lineup? Was it a three-piece or was it a four-piece?
Well, me and Jeremy were the only, like, members. And then Gabe Gonzalez, he produced it and he played, like, 1,000 instruments. It's a fairly pop record, like, you know, it's like, you know, it's got a lot of keyboards and strings on it and stuff like
that's
that
weird.
So
okay.
I wanted to do something more closer to, like, I guess like it was more singer-songwriter oriented, and the second record was a little bit more rock, and then the third record was like a little bit more rock, and now it just kind of happens, like we just ended up like, you know, rocking more, I guess. I think it comes from, like, sitting around and writing songs at your house, and I can be, like, in sort of a mellow, like, contemplative mood or whatever, you know? And then you're like, I'm going to write these songs for a project, and so you end up writing like this. Because I love, like, really, you know, like, kind of mellow shit, like, dreamy type stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you go out and play it, and you're in a bar full of drunk people, and you're like, fuck, is not going to work. And so when you're on the road all the time, I think you just kind of subconsciously start to like, I mean, that tends to be like where I go. Like I start to make stuff that's like a lot more like hard hitting type thing.
And I mean, to me, there's nothing wrong with that except for that it's just a drag. I was talking about this just yesterday when I was talking to Lang from Sounds Under Radio. There's like, it just doesn't come off in a bar. Like you can't have certain dynamics in a bar.
Yeah.
Because unless the entire audience is like there, you know, with you mm-hmm. and to see you and into your trip so much that they know when to, you know, not talk and stuff like that. It's just not, it's really hard to get that when somebody's had a couple of drinks or something.
I can't figure out how to, I've been wondering how to do that my whole life. Like just like, we're talking about writing a full length, you know, like I have written, I've got like 6 songs that I've written since we released the EP, but only 3 of them I feel like are work within the framework that I've made for the Sideshow Tragedy as a band. Like I've got these kind of more mellow songs but I don't know what to do with them. Cause it's like you said, I mean, you get in a bar and it's like, how are people going to be like super into your trip? Like no one gives a shit. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, especially when, I mean, they might, I mean, we could play in Austin and like put together this badass bill and like all of our friends are going to come out and all the fans are going to come out and they're going to be like, and if it's like, all right, y'all be quiet and listen, they will. But I mean, if you're traveling around and you're constantly trying to win over an audience, forget it. You know, it's not going to work. So I don't know. I don't know if it's short attention span or just how loud our culture is, or everybody's like screaming all the time. Yeah. Like billboards are screaming. Like a billboard is screaming at you when you're driving down the road. You're being yelled at all the time. So I guess people just don't. I don't know. I'm not mad at them. I'm not like bitter about it. But it is kind of a drag. Like can't do quiet stuff. Seems like unless you've already got them.
Then also, I mean, you know. It, playing to your audience is also not a stupid thing to do because it's going to make you be able to have your job and do it better, you know? And if you're comfortable doing that kind of music, it's not like, you know, you're doing something that's totally against.
Oh yeah. No. I love it. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so you're not being disingenuous with your art. So it's good. It's like, I remember seeing, like a Behind the Music or that you've ever seen the show Classic Albums.
Mm-hmm.
There's one about Def Leppard, Pyromania, or no, Hysteria, and
it's probably my second favorite record.
Really?
No.
Well, anyway, Mutt Lange, the guy that produced their record, was
he produced Highway to Hell.
Highway to Hell, did. And he was talking about the drummer and that the drummer had these grace notes and stuff, and he was like, "Man, you play stadiums, you know, you play arenas. There's no such thing as a grace note in it.
Yeah,
your fills." Don't build it. Your fills go bam, boom, doo, doo, bam, bam. You know, that'll work in an arena, mm-hmm. you know, setting. You know, where it's so bombastic. You got to play with the places you're playing. You know.
Yeah, I mean, and some of
Do you win? Do you find that you win over people easier because your music is so just like right out of the gate, like it's aggressive. There's energy. You're like coming out. You're fair on a while. You know.
Oh shit, dude. Like, I mean, I'm not like saying like it's not. I don't know either. Too if I mean. It's hard to evaluate your own art, I think. Like, I certainly hold myself to a certain standard. Like, I mean, you know, 2 out of 3 songs I write go in the trash can. No one ever hears them. I can be writing it and I'm like, oh, this is great. William Burroughs talked about that. And like, he says, if you're writing something and you're like, this is great. This is the best thing I ever read. He says, throw it away. It's terrible. Throw it in the neighbor's garbage.
Right.
So, but I don't know if maybe I'm just like this. I don't know if it connects more because I'm just better at writing that kind of material or performing it, or if it has to do with, I tend to think that it's because of what people respond to normally in a bar setting, you know? I don't know. It's because I'm wondering, I'm like, maybe I'm just not any good at writing quiet music, you know? But I don't think that's true.
Maybe you aren't.
Maybe I'm not. I don't know.
I'm joking.
I don't know. It's like what I'm saying. I guess it's for someone else to say, but I mean, it's the kind of thing that's going to get like, you know, if you can listen to it on a record and it, you know, or you're driving in a car and it's like, you're, you know, by yourself or whatever. And you can, you know, or on a movie or something, you know, like a song comes on and it's like some kind of powerful, like melancholic type, mm-hmm. type thing, which I love, like that kind of music, like cinematic type of stuff.
Yeah.
But when, you know, what we are in the trenches, like we're beer salesmen.
Right.
You know, that's what we do.
Yeah, I mean, so, essentially, that's ultimately what we're doing.
It's really, just that line. It's like when I, you know, I'll get so stoked on a song and be like, oh, this song is fucking great. It's the best song I've ever written. And then I get up on stage and I see it coming up in the set list, and I've got these people in the palm of my hand because I've been just blowing it out, rocking all night. And then it gets to that point and I'm like, oh, this is my favorite song. I got to skip it. You know, can't play it. I'm going to lose them. They're all going to go outside and smoke cigarettes.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's one of those weird things. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. But you kind of like become, here's a good sports analogy. You kind of become like a quarterback. You know, you read the defense, mm-hmm. you know, and you know if you can run a certain play.
Yeah, totally. Sometimes I can get away with singing those songs. Yeah.
And you know, sometimes you can't. So you guys, you and Jeremy made this record, this EP in 8 hours.
Yeah.
4 songs.
Yeah.
And you did it to tape. Then you released it on vinyl and then download.
Uh-huh.
And then you've been playing consistently ever since. Have you gotten radio play? Have you gotten...
Well, I think most of the... I mean, like, we're getting played on, like, on podcasts and...
God, I need my applause button.
We're getting played on podcasts mostly, like stuff like that. Like, I mean, I don't know if KLBJ plays it, I think, here in town, but or some, and there's some college radio places here and there that have played it, but I don't know. It's you know, commercial radio is like really tough to get into for somebody that's in our position. So
Do you guys handle your own? Do you guys have a team? Do you have a manager? Do you have a booking agent or anything? You kind of handle everything in-house and do it yourself?
I handle everything ourselves. Yeah.
That's awesome.
We do the whole thing ourselves. We had a booking agent for a while, and it didn't work out. So it just kind of seems to me like, you know, if you really at this point, you know, being small guys or farm leagues or whatever, you know, a sports analogy, just no one's gonna care. You're not like your name doesn't mean enough to make someone stand up and pay attention. So. You're the one who has to sell it to people. You're the one who cares more about it than someone else does. Typically, I think, you know, there's a line in, Martin Atkins wrote this book called Tour Smart, which is about like being an indie musician and touring. And I mean, some of it's like tour bus, like even if you're at that level to like being the smallest band heading out in a van for the first time. It's a lot of advice. It's a really funny book. Actually, you'd like it. But, he says, you know, when he talks about booking agents, he says, you're trying to book shows, you want to play shows because you care about your art enough to where you think that it's important enough to where someone else is going to care, and you want to only do that with your life, and it means more to you than anything else in the world. You know, you poured all of yourself into it. And he says a booking agent wants to make his boat payment.
Yeah,
you know, so
yeah, that's
I mean,
true.
And that's not,
I mean, that's a, except there are exceptions.
Oh,
there are people
sure.
That,
I mean, there's
that
people
are,
that
you
are,
know, that bond, and I'm sure you
right.
know.
But I think for a small indie band, like I think that, you know, as an artist, like your instinct is to be like, well, I'm an artist, and I don't need to be handling like
right.
the business. I need to get a booking agent. And it's like, man, you need to wait on that. You need to wait until booking agents are clamoring at your feet.
Right. Until you can make money for a booking agent, because ultimately, too, like,
right.
you know, there are people, I know, either people.
This pie's too small to cut up
right,
another
exactly.
way.
It's like, you know, if you go and you play, you know, even like local people, like, oh, you know, you meet some guy that, you know, this is, I'm not downing anyone, but it is kind of bullshit. Have some dude that plays, you know, Monday nights at, you know, wherever club here in town, and that's his trip, and there's always like, well, I'm Steve's manager, you know what I mean, there's
right.
like that guy, like, what the fuck do you do,
right, totally,
you know what I mean,
I mean, yeah,
like, what are you managing,
like, I'm the tour manager, and it's like, you're not on tour, what are you talking about,
yeah, I'm the tour,
I think
the,
for a small
I'm the
band,
tour manager,
I instantly, and there's actually, like, I mean, there's, like, there's blogs and stuff all about this on the internet, where it's like, hey, local band, You don't need a manager. You don't have a manager. If your manager comes up and tries to talk to me, I'm going to tell him to fuck off.
Right,
like,
right,
you don't
right.
have a manager. That's your buddy. Like, get right. out of here. You know, it's not real. It's like, so,
right.
you know, yeah, we do everything ourselves and, like, totally, like, we, so know,
I was
that
looking,
we know that we're not big enough to where we need help.
Right.
We've and got plenty of time on our hands.
Yeah, you have a pretty active sense of who you are.
Yeah.
Or a pretty healthy sense of who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is good now. I see that, like, definitely there's reality. There used to be a time when people got out on tour, and even though they were out playing for, like, you know, two uh, 2 to 11 people a night, you know, in different, you know, shitholes. They come back like, oh, man, you wouldn't believe it was amazing. You know, all this bullshit. But you can't do that anymore, you know, really. You can't with the internet and all that stuff. You got to kind of, you know, come clean.
Yeah.
Which is cool because, it's, you know, that bullshit and hype. I actually had this. This actually happened. It was when I put out my last record. There's a guy who's not really my friend, but I've known him for a long time. He's a fucking annoying person who's always got... Sometimes this dude will go like a year. I'm not exaggerating. Like a year and a half. No gigs, no nothing, no nothing.
Wow.
And like, this is my manager. This is my booking agent. You know, that's this guy. So this guy called me.
It seems like it's like based on like watching movies about the music.
Oh, business. Totally, you totally, I mean? Totally. It's like he's pretending. He's right. Doing the. Yeah, he's, yeah, you know. You know what I mean? He's not really there doing. He's not in the moment doing it.
Right.
He's pretending to. He's playing rock star. Yeah. Whatever. So anyway, so he does this. And so this guy, a different guy, calls me from a number I didn't know, and I was my record was just about to come out, and I was planning a record release shows, and this dude's agent called me. He didn't call me, but his booking agent called me. And that also is kind of insulting.
Yeah.
You know, when you know someone and whatever.
Yeah.
So the guy goes, this dude's band had, we're trying to get a stronghold in Houston because the band has the record out. Sorry, I'm going back to the agent guy. And I'm like, okay. Well, I know this dude. I mean, I could just call him and talk to him.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, and so the guy goes on and on about, you know, it's a great gig, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I was like, so what can they bring to the table? And the dude literally told me, he's like, well, they bring 400 people. They're good for about 400 people in Houston. It's like, dude, I know this dude. I know this. That is a lie, you know what I mean? Yeah, like, what a bullshit, you know, trip. But I'm glad that thing's kind of ending.
Well, yeah, it's well, they're still there.
And who's this shyster that's like in, you know, wherever, like Minnesota or something? I mean, oh, I do have a booking agent in Chicago, I'm not gonna lie, but I'm in a cover band that makes some money, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, and I've had a booking agent, and you know, I'll have another one again, hopefully. Mm-hmm. You know, it's good
because it's tough, because also when you're out there selling yourself like that, you're really begging for your job.
You are.
And these, you know, if you're catching someone doesn't know who you are, a lot of times they have attitude and they're tired of, like, as you know, people call like, oh, we're good for about 400 people here. Well, have you ever even been here? No.
Yeah, how's that even? Yeah, I don't get it. And it's people have all these I mean, when I started out doing this, man, like, and I'm not like, you know, I don't want to be like when I was young or any of this shit, but like I had no fucking idea like how anything worked. And there weren't, this was like sort of like the dawn of like these, like, not the dawn, I mean, like, you know, DIY has been like, that's like punk rock, you know, like from late 70s, I guess, is kind of when that like really started to catch on, like these bands booking tours, you know, like Black Flag Minor Threat and shit like that. But I mean, like, when it kind of made its way into, like, I guess, the like folk circle, right. Like that was kind of like late 90s, early 2000s when that started to happen. And it started to become like this network for that. I mean, at least that's when I got into it. There certainly weren't any books.
Right.
Or websites about it.
Right.
And nobody where I'm from, like little small town, had any idea how to do any of this shit. And they're like, well, you need to get a manager.
Yeah.
I'm like, how do you do that? Who do you call? Like,
and what do they do?
Like, I didn't know what any of this shit was. So, I mean, I'm like, I need to make a record. They're like, well, you got to get a record deal. Yeah. And I'm like, so I just started making records. I just found a place that pressed CDs and I just started making them. I just started doing it myself. Nobody told me how to do it. And so then it's just really weird to have like kind of learned by doing for you know, so long, and then to like encounter people that are like, well, this is my agent, this is my and I know that they only bring like three people to a show. It's like, what, who's paying these people?
Right.
You know, like, how's that work? So it's just, I've certainly encountered a lot of that. And you know, giving people like benefit of the doubt when you have like these dudes that book for a club or own some 2-bit production or promotion company, they won't come up after a show and talk to me. Well, you know, like the replacements had a manager because they didn't. Well, none of them had a driver's license, so they had somebody drive them to shows.
Right.
And also because they didn't want to talk to the dipshit at the bar who wanted to talk to him after a gig. Like, I know this. Yeah. I'm gonna make you famous.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't. It's amazing to me that you know, this is a cartoon character, a stereotype basically that exists for amongst musicians, right?
Oh yeah.
And it's in movies, it's everywhere, and these guys still exist, like completely
totally
free of irony, like think they're, you know, it's bizarre to me. Like, have you not ever seen movies about this shit? Like, have you not heard people talking about it?
Yeah.
It's just weird. Like, you guys are good, and I know some people that can help you. Yeah. It's like, whatever. Show me, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, 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 exactly. So, as you're getting at it, first with that, was that, so you guys, you booked a tour now that you're going to leave on. We're, August 11th. Somebody might be listening to this in the future, like, you know, even as far as next year or something. So it's August 11th, 2011. You guys are doing a tour east.
Yeah. Well, we've kind of doing this, like, we've been sort of like, I mean, I don't know. We have like a real blue collar ethic about playing shows where it's like, oh, we're not playing three shows this week. What's going on? We're fucking off. This is lame.
Yeah. I saw there's not a whole lot of days off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like in July we didn't play a lot. So, which I mean, bands do it all the time. There's nothing wrong with it, but right. I have like this, I don't know, it's like some kind of Puritan
thing. Work ethic.
Yeah. But
yeah, you have a work ethic,
but we're doing, so just to sort of like get our sea legs back. We're playing, like we played Houston and Austin earlier this week. And then tonight we're playing College Station and playing Alpine on Friday and El Paso on Saturday and then Dallas next week before we head east to, and I think New Orleans is the first date. And then we head across the south up to New York City and then back across through like Pennsylvania and Ohio to Chicago and back down through the Midwest. So that'll keep us busy until the ACL festival. We'll be back right before that.
Are you playing ACL?
No, we're playing this thing called Ditch the Fest Fest.
What's that?
Which is this thing that this Lucy the Poodle, the promotion company, they put it on. They did it last year, and it was really cool. It was at Cheer Up Charlie's, where, like, I'm talking, like, I don't know, a shit ton of bands, like over 100. They had three stages. I don't know. Maybe not 100. Maybe I'm exaggerating. I'm prone to hyperbole. But there was a lot of people. There was a lot of bands. It was a really cool party, and we played that, but we played at, like, 11 o'clock in the morning, or we were, like, the second band that played it, you know. But they're doing it again this year, and it's not just at Cheer Up Charlie's. It's at Red 7, Beauty Bar, and Club DeVille as well as Cheer Up Charlie's. So it's at four places. So it's sort of this deal where, I guess, bands that aren't playing ACL. Actually, I think there might be some that are playing ACL that are also doing this, you know. Like,
wow.
But I think it's for people who are like, you know, they don't want to go to Zilker and deal with the crowds, or right. They don't have the, you know, I don't. How much is a three-day pass?
I don't know.
It's like hundreds of dollars, I think, at this point.
Sure.
I went like a long time ago, and it was fairly cheap, but it's expensive. It's got to be at least like $200 or something, or $150 for a three-day pass. So it's just one of these deals where, you know, people in town that don't either have the means or the desire to go to right. ACL can go do something else. So that's what we're doing.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. There'll yeah. be a bunch of out-of-towners.
And so how long is your tour? It's a month?
No, it's
I mean, you're already on it, right? It's a little, where did you play last night, you said?
Oh, we played in Austin two nights ago, we played in Houston last weekend. So,
okay.
But we're, I guess, yeah, I mean, you know.
Do you hook up with other bands on these? Or are these just like your
yeah,
shows?
Yeah, we have friends.
Like friends like, hey, let's put yeah. the show together.
Yeah, totally. Like, we have some friends, where are we playing? Yeah, it's generally a lot better, I think, particularly in towns where there's like a big, you know, like a big music scene,
yeah.
you know, like a New York sure. or something sure. like that.
Yeah, you can put shows. So you're playing Rockwood in New York. I saw that. I play there as well.
Yeah.
Who are you playing with there? Do you know?
There's a band called Rumblefoot. They do like surf music, like old, like Link Ray type stuff. Oh. And, you know, like Dick Dale, stuff like that.
Right.
Which, you know, that was actually the club's idea for us to play with them. But you know, it should be a good show. Rockwood's yeah. it's a cool place.
I love that place.
I like playing there. It's about the smallest club I've ever played, I think. Like, it's definitely really small, but you know, makes it really easy to sell out.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
I always feel like I have this massive following in New York.
Yeah, totally. I fucking made it.
Fucking spilling into the no man, they had to watch it on the TV in the other room. You know, they have a bigger room now though.
Yeah, they do.
People yeah. are telling me.
It's anyway, like, but it's like, you know, maybe its capacity is like 60 instead of 30 or something like that. So
when you guys go out, it is just you two. You don't take like a merch person.
No,
and
you're
married, right?
I am married. Yeah. Okay. But no merch person. We are taking one this time though.
Oh, you are?
This tour, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Merch person / tour manager. I'm going to try it
Driver.
Out. Driver. Yeah. yeah. But we're going to.
That's the toughest thing. I mean, I can only imagine, you know, when it's a band of. If a bunch of people, nobody really wants to drive after the first 2 days. You
no,
know?
And it's one of those things, too, where it's just like we're these, like, me and Jeremy are these hard-headed, like, like torture ourselves, you know, like, man, fuck it, dude, I'm a badass, I'm gonna drive 8 hours today, like, yeah. You know, and you end up being really miserable on the road and stuff, but we still do it. We're like, man, look how tough we are, look how much we drove, we're truckers.
Yeah.
And then every time a trucker drives by, you know, a big rig drives by, you're like, fuck, that guy's making way more money than I am.
Yeah, that's true.
Doing the same job, basically.
Right, because that's what you're getting paid for. They're not paying for you to play the shows. They're paying you to drive and to sit around.
Yeah,
totally. It's always my favorite thing. Well, is there anything else you want to say? Is there anything you feel we missed? I enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, I had fun, too. This was fun.
It was never awkward.
No, not at all.
And you kept your pants on the whole time, so...
Was I
made me feel safe?
Okay.
I know you have a reputation. I do. Once you get comfortable to take your pants off,
it's a little early in the day, but you know, we'll do a podcast at midnight and see how that goes.
Yeah, come back. We'll do part two.
Yeah. Anything to say? If you're listening and you live in any of the towns that the Sideshow Tragedy is playing, come to a show. Say hi.
Come out and see them. They're an amazing band. You can check them out at www.thesideshowtragedy.com. And they have EPs, records. If you're a vinyl person, you should try and find their vinyl somewhere in Austin. I bet you can find it at Waterloo.
Yep.
And check out their tour dates. They might be coming to a town near you. They're going out east. They're going to be in Alpine tomorrow. College Station tonight, Alpine tomorrow, El Paso the next day.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's...
Yeah.
You guys are going like halfway across the United States.
I know, right? Austin's closer, or El Paso's closer to Phoenix than it is to Austin.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a. Luckily, you'll be in the East Coast, and you'll have some nice drives. Do you have a tour diary or something like that when you're out on the road? Do you keep people informed of what you're doing, or kind of, you know, do a blog or anything?
Yeah,
like that?
Well, I think I think Jeremy's on Twitter, but he mostly just posts like extremely bizarre non sequiturs. So if you're looking for like,
that's very important. Do you know his handle on Twitter?
I think it's Mr. Wolfenstein or something like that.
All right, so look for Mr. Wolfenstein and check out the sideshowtragedy.com and pick up their EP, Gasoline. And there's a video also for the song Gasoline.
Yeah.
Which your wife did.
Right? Yeah, my wife, she filmed it, and her brother, my brother-in-law, edited it. So
it's a great video. And thanks. The band is really energetic and really worth your time. If you get to go see them, look them up and check out their tour diary. I can hear the yard guys coming with their blowers.
And check Johnny's band out too, Liars and Saints.
Liars and Saints.
I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is I think I am going to have like a little masturbatory few minutes where people give me a psychic HJ.
Well, it is your podcast.
It is my podcast. But it's our podcast.
It's our podcast.
And so we found out how...
It's for the people.
How Nathan got here. He got here through East Texas. Running for his life from a town that he literally refused to name.
No. It's not that I refuse to name any particular
town.
I
love it, though.
There's just so many that it's embarrassing. Like, right. You know, I moved around so much that it's just like, I don't even want to talk about it. Like,
I'm going to leave the audience with this before we go. And thank you for coming by. Thanks for making time.
Thanks for having me.
To do shows. I hope that some people hear about you and buy your record and come out and see you guys play. I had a band called Your Wiener for a very short period of time with my friends Chris King and Matt Hammond and Jay Gomez from Mineral. And it was all funk, and sound is coming. So we had this rap song. I'm going to make it real fast. We did it over the groove of I Love Rock and Roll. But I did mention an East Texas town, which is super awesome. One of the rhymes went supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. When I pull my wiener out, it goes from here to Nacogdoches. All right, thank you. Nathan Singleton from the Sideshow Tragedy. Have a good one. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
So that was my conversation with Nathan from the Sideshow Tragedy. That's episode 3. We're going to have episode 4 coming up pretty soon with Donnie Wynn, a very accomplished musician, drummer, almost like a medicine man, like a shaman. We have other ones coming up. Shane Lawler from Electric Touch. In September, we'll have Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's. So keep on listening. It's How Did I Get Here? Enjoy it. This is more... Sideshow Tragedy, this song is called Gasoline. Thanks.